Hi, I'm Susan Early, and I'm with the Visual Arts Center of Richmond, and I want to welcome you all to Steve Scafidi's poetry reading today, and happy National Poetry Month. This reading came about thanks to Carol Weinstein and Leslie Scheel. A few years ago, Carol gave us some money to endow the Leslie Scheel Scholarship for Creative Writing here at the Visual Arts Center, and that has gone to individuals over the last few years, but this year Leslie decided she wanted to open it up and bring something bigger that more people could enjoy. So she invited Steve to come here for the weekend, and he accepted, which we're delighted for. So this is Leslie and Carol's scholarship to the community. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Leslie to introduce Steve, and I hope you all enjoy.
So you're all scholarship winners. You could leave feeling that welcome. It's so good to be here. And thank you, Susan, the stamina of the Visual Arts Center and all of the events that you've had in the last couple of weeks is just amazing to me. So look at this journal. The reason that I brought this is that when I was thinking of this reading, I knew that in 1988, I had taught my first poetry workshop at VCU, and I wasn't a graduate of the program yet. I had a year to do my thesis. I had done all of the coursework, and so I found this August 31st, 1988. This is the first line, written on my last night of being poor, because I got a job. Okay, so some things don't happen, but I thought, oh man, the writing, you know, 1988. And I bring this in because that is the day that I met Steve Scafidi. He was in that very first poetry class. I used to plan the class at Hollywood Cemetery, and I remember the first poem that he handed in. I was at Schaefer Court when the skateboarders still got to be there, and I missed that so much. It was so wonderful to be a person who's so in her head, like watching these people and going, oh my God, to be able to do that in a poem. And I remember I had Steve's poem there, and it was this enchanting work about animals drinking, and I went, what have we here? And sat down, and I knew at that moment that my work with this particular person as a teacher would be to just say what I saw as clearly and deeply as possible, then to get out of the way. And that's how that first semester went. What happened then is that Steve was in town for a while, many long walks through the fan, a time taken away from undergraduate study to wash dishes at the Strawberry Street Cafe, and then back into it, off to Arizona to study with Norman Doobie, and more night walks then. Is now in West Virginia, the father of two kids, married, a cabinet worker, and teaching at Johns Hopkins on Fridays. Yesterday, he was on the road 11 hours, 5 hours there and 6 hours back because of traffic. So I'm so happy that he's here with us. But the two things that I'm going to say about his work are, first of all, one of the things I love about it is that he unflinchingly looks at the sorrow of our collective history. Poems about the death of Emmett Till, an ode to Rosa Parks, about the execution of Carla Faye Tucker, a poem that mentions Anne Frank and the life that she wasn't able to live, and what if. Even characters from all of his deep reading life, for instance, Icarus, and he starts out a poem, Icarus, revived by the cool water and the plunge and breathless, Icarus swam back to shore, toweled off and told the world the news of his demise was premature and shouted his name to the sun and millenniums past. And so he brings this deep reading life to the work as well, but he doesn't leave us at the point of sorrow. He doesn't back away from it, But then fusing that with the imagination, he opens up that space that we have to take on those hard facts that nothing will make okay. But he does things like this in writing about Emmett Till in a fairly long poem about how hard that story is. Near the end of the poem, he does this. And I think of Emmett Till's grandmother, the moment she heard the news of his lynching, and how she flew from the grave and held his lost, bewildered shade under the shade of a beautiful child's wrecked body, and the things that she said to comfort him are the secrets, I suspect, we will learn when death's mob swarms and cusses and drags us away. So he does that kind of imagining too, towards a kind of redemption that can't happen all of the way, but it could broaden the field a little bit and in order for us to take on those facts. So it is with deep pleasure that I bring probably, I just am going to say it, the person who is my favorite contemporary poet because of what he does for readers in poems that are so skillful with language, but also are not afraid to show us that healing and love are also part of the expanded context of bearing those sorrows. Steve Scafidi.
Thank you all so much for having me here. You can see how I lucked out in my first poetry class, and it was true for all of the poets here at VCU when I was a student, and it's still true, I imagine. But it was true that I lucked into coming into a place, my father grew up here, I have loads of family here, but I wouldn't have made it to college. I was a terrible student. I tell my students at Hopkins, I dropped out of college 3 times. You know, I'm so proud of them and amazed at them. But I lucked out in coming to a place, all I knew is that I loved poetry. It's all I knew about life. And I hardly knew what that meant. But I found myself among people who are still devoted to the art and took me and my poetry seriously, which had to have been close to impossible, I think. Being a 21-year-old man with, or 19, whatever I was, who didn't know anything but that he loved one thing. And so I completely lucked out, and I've been lucky ever since with our friendship. I just want to thank you very much for having me here. I can't imagine who I would be as a writer without, and I think people in this room know, I have a feeling many of you know Leslie, if not everyone. I've been lucky ever since, so thank you very much. We've all been watching the news and hearing about what's going on in Japan. I wanted to somehow, in a small way, combat the images we've been seeing with some smaller images by a poet named Yosa Buson, who lived in the 18th century in Japan. I'm going to read just two of them, one now and one at the end. Just a small haiku that Robert Haas, his version of them. Apprentice's day off, hops over a kite string, keeps going. Do you all know people who are known by both of their names? There's a man at our shop named John Brown. He has a big beard like the historical John Brown, but he has very gentle, sweet eyes and a sweet temperament. He's a very nice young man, but we all call him John Brown. And one day I said to him, I said, John Brown, why do we call you John Brown? And he said, well, I guess it's because of the historical figure. And I said, yeah, you're right, John Brown. You're probably right. But tell me, what does your mom call you? And he said, John Brown. So here's a poem like that. It's called 10-Letter Word for a Lucky Man. I like to open this as my way of saying hello to you in a more proper way, I guess, which is through a poem. 10-Letter Word for a Lucky Man. Jimmy Toombs, you have the best name in the county as far as I'm concerned. And the woman I overheard today, in the way she said your name softly, combining your first and last name into one sound. And she was in the booth behind me at Fran's place, and Jimmy Toombs, she said, and Jimmy Toombs, Jimmy Toombs, Jimmy Toombs, for an hour going on about your private business. And I thought, there is no finer thing ever to happen in a man's life but to have a woman fall in love with you and for her to sweetly tell her friend your name over and over in a public place. And that, Jimmy Toombs, truly makes you the luckiest man with the best sounding name in the whole green state of Virginia. And her friend was quiet as your friend spoke, and spoons lightly touched the sides of coffee cups being stirred all over the restaurant. And when the waitress came over to clear a dish or ask a question of the woman who loves Jimmy Toombs and the friend of the woman who loves Jimmy Toombs, their conversation stopped momentarily. And I went back to the Zippy the Pinhead in the crossword puzzle in the Washington Post. But it was impossible, Jimmy Toombs. And when my slice of pie came with whipped cream, the waitress carried two other small blue plates in her left hand. And I listened, Jimmy Toombs, when she said, his kiss is like a feather. And we ate pecan pie, the three of us, quietly, all together. That's from my first book, Sparks from a 9-Pound Hammer. I'm going to read a poem from my second book called For Love of Common Words, published with LSU Press. And the editor is Dave Smith, who used to teach here. He was kind enough to publish these and to also offer a cabinet maker the opportunity to teach a poetry class where he's teaching, where really no one else would give a cabinet maker a chance, I think, to do such a thing. So I've been lucky more than I deserve, I feel like. And that's not a complaint. This is a poem called Witness to the Work. Largely it's about standing in the room, the delivery room, when my first child was born. I love my wife, I've been in awe of her before, but being in that room, I was struck dumb by what she just did. Gave birth naturally to a child, and she got into a kind of trance, it seemed, when she did this. The women here, many of you must know, but to me it's still unbelievable, like a dream, that it actually happened, that she actually did it. So anyway, it's a poem about standing to the side and witnessing something. Witness to the work. If I could knock a house down with my crotch, or pull a train cross-country with a little string tied to my cock, well then, that would be something. Not much, but at least something. If I could breathe in sharply now and swallow the western half of Portugal with its bright umbrellas and pointy cathedrals and its statues of Fernando Pessoa, it might be the same. If I could just think of the pain, I would fall over like a lettuce. As it is, a great and growing awe comes between us now, and we do not speak of it. Months pass, more months. She cries out suddenly, and her cries are deep, like nothing I've ever heard, and the car zigzags, and we are there. Then the hours pass, filled with a difficult kind of grace. And she pushes that baby out of her, and the baby finally says, okay, and galumph, just like that, this lump of breath falls into the world and is lifted to her mother's breast. And she is crying, and people are snipping and cutting, saying, oh, isn't she, isn't she? And the room is spinning hard, and the spinning spins the earth, and the earth spins faster. And I always thought that life was like a blue donkey named Disaster that we ride to death and whisper to. Now I know it is this bloody, holy work the mothers do. In my poetry classes, sometimes I talk about Horace and his poem Ars Poetica, which was a letter he wrote to the Emperor Augustus about how to write a poem. We've all probably bumped into it sometimes. It's great. Long poem. I love it. I like being told of things. I mean, that's why I like being told what poetry is. You always can disagree, but I like when people know what it is and they say it. Because I'm often in a position of bewilderment about poetry, the thing I love best, it seems. And I don't mean that in just rhetorically. I mean it with my heart. I'm in a position of bewilderment often, which makes the experience of writing crucial to me and exciting at the same time, because I don't know what I'm doing. I have instincts and muscle memory up in here, I imagine, and yet I don't know, but I trust whatever happens and see what happens. But anyway, I like Horace for saying what he thinks, and he knows what he thinks. And one of the things he says in his Ars Poetica is, he says, to avoid novelty, for example, avoid something in a poem like a dolphin in the forest or a wild boar in the waves. Of course, that's what you want to write a poem about when you hear that. And so that's what I did. And I do this with my students. I always have them write a poem about a dolphin in the forest. But it is important for people who do know what poetry is, it's important for you to say, no, I'm going to do it anyway. Especially if you're a student, it's important, I think, to have that kind of testing. But Horace, I guess, never lived through the surrealistic movement, though I imagine the Roman Empire was a surreal movement itself. But that is a lot of talking to introduce a very small poem. Horace would have a problem with that too, probably. But this is a poem for, I imagine, for our fathers, that we're all in that position. I guess, speaking of bewilderment, maybe that's part of the relationship. Diving through the forest. The dolphin in the woods leaps from tree to tree, and his only wind is only the yellow of poplar leaves in the blue of September where the little windows are. Every day our fathers live, they breathe the air that was something else in another time. If the atom is to be believed, we all shift and change. What was the river becomes the cloud. What we wanted to say, we never could. It was obvious. It was hidden, like the dolphin in the woods. I was raised in an area of Virginia that's right beside the Blue Ridge Mountains. I still work there, but so much development has occurred there in the last 20 years that really 4 or 5 generations have changed to this area in pretty much a half a generation. So those of us who were raised there have been chased, essentially, over the mountain and into West Virginia, where I live now as an adult. And I love it there. The shop that I work in is still there. And so I see the destruction of a place that I love. And yet, there's still these big buzzards that live there and fill the skies. And they're beautiful to see a vulture fly. And so, in a way, when I see the vultures of my home county, I think I'm seeing my neighbors, my old friends. And at one time, in fact, on the way to my shop, there was a dead raccoon on the road, and there was like 8 vultures around it. And I was driving up to the shop. It's a dirt road, and there were like 3 SUVs stuck because they didn't know how to deal with it. With the vulture, because the vultures were not going to get out of the way. And I was like, oh, yes, thank you. It was wonderful. This is called Naked Sunlit Afternoon with Vultures. The charismatic bodies of the dead draw them down quietly, imperceptible, from the circle in the sky to the sycamore trees in the roadside we see every day, decked in the common gore our speed leaves behind for these birds to pick at slowly, who strut and stutter primitive things, hungry to eat and be glutted by death. Oh, Byzantine black angels, always smelling at the aftermath of a sad fact. Today, in the very middle of one beautiful afternoon, you watched me strip down to boots and wander a deep creek's boulders, water falling everywhere, and in the blue sky descended to the near trees as I splashed, sank, swam, and then spread out on a rock with lichen stuck to my body as one by one you passed exactly between me and the sun, so your shadows touched my body quickly as I guess you looked for some living reflex or reaction. And did so then receive one, as I waved and called you all near, wondering if perhaps one brave, starved member of your community, too zonked on sunlight to wait for my death, would come at me. And the idea of wrestling you to the ground and breaking you apart in my arms was wonderful, as meanwhile all 8 of you settled in the near trees, scritching, anxious in the branches, while I breathed the air my winter body shared with your dark wings. And so, on this beautiful day, too full of the sun's bright clarity and the joy of swimming naked, and too full of late April's mosses and buds bursting on the mussel trees. Your eerie, hard leering is part of the promise I have made to Kathleen in my family, in the dearly beloved friends I live to delight here in these long letters, to never kill myself or anyone else or thing now moving quiet suddenly under love's low wheel. For the last 3 years, I've been writing some poems about Abraham Lincoln. When I first started this project, I would say, if anyone asked, that I was writing what I thought was a magical biography of Abraham Lincoln. And one of my friends at the shop said, "You mean you're making it up?" So here's a poem from that. I'm just gonna read one. This project is gigantic. It's taken over my life, and I think I'm ending it now, but the project. but it's about 200, it's embarrassing to say, it's like 250 pages long. And Leslie's read it and helped me kind of wrestle it somewhat and get some clarity and I think some closure. I don't think I could have done it without your help as a reader. But anyway, I don't even know how to talk about it hardly, but I would like just to read a chunk of it, a small little piece of it. And it goes from when he was born in 1809 all the way up to 1922 when the Lincoln Memorial was dedicated and which his son, Robert, his sole surviving son, attended that dedication. It's a beautiful photograph of Robert, his son, as an old man with a beard, sitting in a chair where all the dignitaries have either not have already left or they haven't yet arrived. Maybe you've seen this picture. And he's looking over his shoulder and he looks lost. It's such a beautiful picture. That's not what this is about, but I don't know, I'm not the only one. I think many of us, we fall in love with Lincoln. I have, and it kind of took me by surprise, the depth of it. Anyway, he's an interesting man, and there's something too, I think, that makes you, when you think and write about someone like him, you find yourself falling in love with our country in ways that I didn't suspect. And it's been, I think of what T.S. Eliot said in Tradition and Individual Talent, which I read here in Richmond, where he says at one point in this essay, he says, "There comes a time in every poet's life when the life of your culture or of your country becomes more important than your own mind, or the mind of your culture becomes more important than your own mind." And I remember being 19 or 20 and going, whoa, I need to live with that. I don't even know how to begin to think of it. But I never have forgotten, and I've thought of it. And I thought that this project was a time when such a thing was happening. I don't even know if that's what Eliot meant, but it's the only time I felt swamped. Maybe novelists know this, swamped by something other. And yet I'm clarified by it somehow. This is just a poem just before Antietam, the battle near Sharpsburg, Maryland. This is called The Cavalry. Under cover of the stars in July, a farmer arrived with seven huge Appaloosas snorting on the lawn of the White House. One was wild, bucking against the ropes and the wide net, pinning its wings down. And Lincoln smiled, marveling at what some sugared oats and Vermont grass had made of these horses leaping against the bindings. "Cavalry, cavalry," said the man. "Imagine your new cavalry running through the sky." Lincoln ran his hand along the feathers, stiff as shingles, soft as a lady's arm, and the man motioned for him to climb on. And when he was situated, holding tight, the farmer cut loose the netting and watched the president laugh as the creature bucked hard and rose into the air. The Department of War bought all of the horses, which were shot from the sky one at a time over Sharpsburg, falling into the houses like bombs. I'm going to read a poem now about when my wife was pregnant with our second child, our son. A boy in Frederick, Maryland was abducted and raped and murdered. And I read it in the paper, this story. I had a little picture of him and his abductor at a 7-Eleven buying a Slurpee. And it just crushed me. And I was, you know, I think so. I don't know if it happens to all of us, but I have a sense it does. But I know it does to me, that sometimes either a thing I see or I hear, I can't shake it. You know, I can't watch some movies. My wife can watch anything, but I can't. I have to kind of guard myself, I feel like. Not to sound, oh, I'm sensitive, but perhaps I am, because some things just wreck me. And this one did, and not in an outward way. I lived my life. I don't even think I even mentioned it to anyone. I didn't speak a word of it, but I couldn't shake it. The horror of what had happened. And the notion that here I am bringing in a child to this world that suddenly I hated, that I despised. Again, I'm not saying any of this. I'm living my life, and I'm not even breaking anything. But I couldn't shake it. And so I entered into something which I think, in a way, I've been preparing myself for in some way. You know, writing helps me live my life. I imagine many of you all do something, all of us do something creative. I have friends who will not read a poem, and I love them dearly, but they can come to a lathe, a turning lathe, and they can lean against the bowl and then glide back a little bit, you know, light as a feather with the chisel. And it's just art, it's art to watch them do this. And then what they make is indeed art, though they wouldn't call it that. But anyway, I think that I started writing poems about this, of course. It's not how much of poetry is obsession, the thing that we can't, you know, you can't turn away from. You know, thank God, you know, I have poetry, some kind of accompaniment to kind of help you, you know, that we all have something to help. It's an accompaniment, isn't it? Something we can lean on, help us live our lives and look for, you know, just kind of, just so the ground doesn't, you know, that it stops being an ocean and it can be the earth again. So, again, this is all dramatic, but I'm just living my life. But every night I'm writing obsessively about this event. And I wrote probably about 120 some drafts, and they were all like different. And finally, I got close, and my house was busy with our child and with work, but I went and, I'd never done this before, but I went to a hotel room to work on this poem. Because I felt like, oh, I think maybe I'm getting somewhere. And I don't even know what that meant to myself, but all I knew was that I felt like I was solving something in my heart so that I could move forward. But it felt like there's that urgency, you know, that I couldn't move forward until I dealt with this somehow. I know I sort of sound like a crazy person, but sort of, right? But I guess that, I think that's part of the vocation, I think, of a writer or a painter or whatever, a guitarist, whatever the hell it is that you do, that you love. It does become a great help. And I think you can probably only be disappointed by after what I've just said, but it's the kind of, yeah, you have no choice. But I guess what I'm saying is, this is a poem I'm very grateful to as a person. Because what is it that then that makes it say, no, 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 that's not it, I didn't get it, no, that's not it, that's not it. And then, I think I'm there. All my students always ask me, how do you know when a poem is finished? And I don't know what to tell them. You know, I don't know. Except that your guts and your instinct and your body, you know, if you sweat or if you relax or you, I don't know. Anyway, the boy inside the pumpkin. At 530 pounds, it won the blue ribbon at the Frederick County Fair, and because all such vegetables are too bitter to eat, something had to be done. And it was decided to haul the pumpkin to the river. And the boy inside the pumpkin, meanwhile, lay curled in the dark mash while they rolled it to the edge of the tailgate and heaved it to the ground. And he must have been in there all spring and all summer through the long hot hours. And through the long hot hours must have grown restless in the goop, although he looked almost peaceful, lying naked by the river among the broken loaves and the seeds where the ambulance drivers stood on their knees, amazed, beside the boy, opening his eyes as the slow Potomac moved to the Chesapeake Bay and the ocean where the waves make their way to every coast in the world. And the boy inside the pumpkin lies quietly in this world like a fact of the unlikely. And the most unlikely things happen every day in this world. And we go on unchanged. And a body was found on a baseball diamond in Frederick, Maryland last spring, wearing only a t-shirt, face down, with both arms underneath the body. And the details are listed in the Metro section of the Washington Post. And so when you read about the child, you learn he was only 9 years old and had a faint birthmark, the exact shape of Kentucky, on the small of his back. He could talk like a duck when he wanted to. And you learn the most unspeakable things in the slender Metro section of the Washington Post. And it corrupts your sense of the world to know how often the impossible happens upon us without mercy. And it is not the fit subject of poetry. And it is offensive to redeem the horror of that boy's last hours. But I can't stop trying to salvage something from the murderous and the poisonous. And last spring, some small, ordinary blossom grew suddenly, more gigantic every day. And the boy inside the vine became the boy inside the pumpkin, who became a turning in the darkness no one noticed, although for a week, hundreds of people at the fair stroked the fat sides of the pumpkin and were amazed. And a boy leans up on his elbows now in the moss beside the river and looks around bewildered and asks for his mother and his father, and they are delivered, amazed. And these things never happen. They happen every day. A friend of mine is a farmer, and he always tries to grow a giant pumpkin. And he told me something last week. He said, well, when they get to be about 50 pounds, you need to feed them milk. And that's what you do. I couldn't believe it. This is a poem about the first job I ever had was a neighbor of mine had some horses. And my job was to go out there, I was about 14, my job was to go out there into his field with a wheelbarrow, and I loved this job, with a shovel, and I would pick up after the horses in the field. And I loved doing it, because as I'm doing it, you know, and kind of where I grew up was there's a lot of horse country. And so the horses are celebrated. And so as I would wheel around with this wheelbarrow and pick up the horse shit, they would look at me, and they seemed to smile. I think it amused them. I'm telling you the truth. Anyway, this is a poem about that. And it's called Ars Aureus, or The Golden Art. First was the golden horseshit, those clumps of grassy dough I picked up with a shovel in my neighbor's meadow. $1 an hour at least, and it took me a few hours a day to pick up after the mares and stallions who'd watch me as I wheeled the barrow here and there and shoveled in the tufty, dirty loaves of seeds and oats. And one afternoon, kneeling in the pasture with all of the horses watching and whisking their long tails in the summer heat, I took a golden seed out of the earth of the horse and rubbed it clean and said the blessing of thanks I learned from my family for the unbroken unity of all things. And it was sweet. Surprisingly sweet, as it is today, reading and writing poetry, doing the work I love. Are y'all doing all right? I'm almost done. The last time I read here was for the Larry Levis Award. And I'm so happy to see you, Greg. I haven't think I've really seen you since then. This is a poem I want to read that uses an epigraph of Larry Levis's. Do we all know what the taint is? It'll become apparent, I guess. It taint in our shop. It's a place on the body, and it taint one thing and it taint the other. That's how we put it at the shop. But there's a guy at my shop who talks a whole lot, and he says that the off switch is on his taint. So no one, there's no turning him up, turning it off. It's also called the perineum. This is called Ode to the Perineum. And the epigraph from Larry Levis is, maybe the soul is only a small place on the body. And maybe not. Maybe the invisible filament that flickers in the idea of the soul is the soul. Some hummingbird of the universal mind, brightly colored, precise, and infinitely quick and dull. It shouldn't be in any case as intimate as, say, the perineum, that pleasurable, 1 millionth acre of nerves that lies between the asshole and the valiant gradual beginning of our sex. No, the soul can't be that close by, and so inappropriate that to speak of it now is to cross over into the language of the body and of the hidden crevasses of the body. Well, the hummingbird now floats over a rose, although such a symbol for the soul, to be honest, must include the microscopic blue turds thudding lightly onto the grass, wherever that hummingbird for you will pass. I prefer the taint, this prairie of pure desire, so secret even the body knows little of its power, until quietly reminded we buck like a horse on some Mississippi street. This deep true south of ourselves, patch of the promised land, kingdom of the cartwheel and the lazy falling handstand and swimming pools. I praise the carnival hares sprouting there like trees Dr. Seuss drew in a forbidden mood. And I praise blue moons, kazoos, and white hot rivers with fiery canoes in that vision of scramble pleasure makes us live through. And I praise this small place on the body that might be the soul, hinge from which our legs swing, tingling thing, like the soft spot on a baby's head, this fragile holy span must be praised now and then with all the gentle force that words can stand. As I've been reading haiku since the catastrophe in Japan, almost all the haiku I've been reading is scary. I guess it doesn't have to be, but there's something else, and something haunting, I guess, is all it is. Here's another one from Busan. Tilling the field, the man who asked the way has disappeared. This would be my final poem. But again, I want to thank you, Leslie, for having me here. It's a delight to come back to this city and to read poems in the one city on earth that that said yes to me when I needed it. This is a poem for my daughter, who's 9 now, but it's written for her when she's older. She's an older woman, and when I'm gone. When this book came out, I have a copy for her, and now she loves poetry. But I haven't wanted her to read my poetry yet. I don't know, but I do want her to read this eventually. To an old woman in the air. As you fly over my grave with your jetpack on turbo to play bingo in Fargo, as your children lift up their children to point at the nearby moon tonight, as you travel toward us who lay lost in death, think of your mother now sleeping with you upstairs. Think of your father asleep on the sofa with a workbook propped on his bony knees. Think of the small overlooked details of who we were once. Your mother's golden bangs almost cut in a straight line that she trimmed with scissors earlier in the round mirror by the kitchen where water cooked in the tea kettle. And my fingertips stained dark walnut from working all day. Think of the way your body wiggled in the bath an hour ago. You are older now than I ever was. I am guessing you have suffered. I am hoping days of unexplained joy ambushed you at every turn, and that your life is saturated with the secret water of days that will always be just a part of a larger water, more powerful than the Shenandoah, beside which your mother and I lived before you were born. I hope the river of your days rushing by grows more graceful as you age. I hope as you fly over our grave today with your jetpack on low, the day is bright and clear, and the traffic through the trees is just sparrows and leaves. Old woman, I can hear you calling, and your mother turning to you right now, this instant. We are all awake now. We are long gone. Baby, old lady, go on. Thank you.